These are the stories and the moments that you need to know about today.
They haven't done us direct damage yet, but we're risking, you know, Boston, New York, Chicago, you name it, that kind of thing. How can people all of a sudden turn against Israel?
The close Russian-Chinese strategic link plays an important stabilizing role on the world stage.
We certainly link this visit with the hope that President Xi will also influence President Putin to end this war in Ukraine, which he cannot win.
There's not just a lot of stuff happening, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening, and we're going to be all over it. Of course, Mr. Putin, during the time when we're going to be on the air here, will be arriving in Beijing, and we probably will be showing it to you live as soon as the feeds and everything gets cleared up. So it's going to be happening while we're on the air. Jay Bowes is going to be joining me. He's going to be sitting right here taking me through Europe's reaction. Also, a very well-known China analyst is going to be joining us, and all the news. Oh, my God, what a show. It's coming your way. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Our numbers keep growing each and every week by millions. And I want to thank you for wanting something that is a little different and for your expectation to make us deliver it for you. So I promised you last week that I was going to keep an eye on Latin America, right, and the Caribbean, because too often this is a place that's ignored by the Western media, even though it's in the West. It's like right under their nose and they still ignore it. I guess not West enough, right? Look, Latin America is a historic mess. I'm from there. It was colonized and brutalized first by the Spaniards, and then the U.S. picked up the ball and they ran with it. And to be honest with you, Washington has been just as bad, if not worse, than the Spanish were, right? In fact, I could say this. The colonization is really still happening to this day in Latin America, but with puppet regimes and leaders who are chosen and then trained and then controlled by Washington. And I'm going to give you an example of one of these folks, right? This guy right here, who you're about to see on the screen, that's Rodrigo Paz of Bolivia. There he is with Marco Rubio, my friend from Miami. And here's what you need to know about this guy, Rodrigo Paz, right? Trained in Washington, D.C., where he became a part of the D.C. establishment, went to school at American University, and since then, he returned to Bolivia to essentially turn his country into a satellite state of the United States. But Bolivians don't seem to be happy with that. They don't like that. They want the guy that they used to have as their president, and that would be this guy. Change. Boom. That's Evo Morales. Now, he may be liked by the people of Bolivia. There's no question about that because, like, he's one of them. But he's despised by Washington for having, quote, leftist tendencies. I mean, there he is with Chavez and with Fidel Castro. So leftist tendencies, right? Sound familiar? Anyway, let me show you what's happening right now in the streets of Bolivia. This is serious. So these are the miners. They were the first to protest. They're upset with the government reforms with Mr. Paz that removed their benefits and their pay. So they've taken to the streets. They're clashing with police. Police are now using tear gas, as you can see, attacking them. And they're trying to control the rioting. All this in defiance of President Paz, who, as the protesters say, is only there, they think, to serve the rich. And now this, look at these pictures. These are others who are joining this protest, right? These are farmers and union workers. They're indigenous groups who are also opposed to Rodrigo Paz as well. They're calling on him to leave the country. They also refer to him as Washington's puppet, Washington's man. And they say the guy they want back in power is their former president, Evo Morales, despite charges brought against him recently. Wow. Let's talk about Israel now, a country getting a rare mix of both love and hate in the United States. First, we'll talk about the love. This is Larry Kudlow, who you're about to see here. He's a right-wing commentator. He used to work in the Trump administration. He was a finance guy. Now, according to Kudlow, all Iranians are Nazis. The Iranians killed 30, 40,000 people. And the Israelis are the most awesome people in the world.
In terms of regime change, the president has said from the beginning he hopes the Iranian people will go and do that, will go and secure the freedoms they want. 42,000 of them lost their lives just for protesting
inhumane.
The repression. Completely inhumane.
I mean, it's the worst.
It's inhumane. It's
Nazi-like.
Lots
I'm
of
sorry.
People are saying
it
since
just
the
is.
Holocaust. Absolutely.
Since the Holocaust.
And we can't look the other way, because look at what happened then. So many leaders looked the other way. Trump's just not a guy who's going to look
how
the other way.
How can a political party possibly oppose this? It is
well,
beyond.
They do.
I know they do. The Democrats do. I don't understand. This is worse than 9/11 in a sense. It's not really worse than 9/11 because we lost almost 3,000 people. I don't want to go down that road. But everybody was united in defense and patriotism of the United States. It's gone now. How can that be? Iran is, in some sense, worse, bigger than al-Qaeda. They haven't done us direct damage yet, but we're risking, you know, Boston, New York, Chicago, you name it, that kind of thing. How can people all of a sudden turn against Israel? A democracy, our best friend for so many years.
How can people turn against Israel? And don't they understand that all Muslims are bad and they should be eliminated? That they're all fanatical? I don't understand why Americans aren't seeing that, he seems to be asking. Wow. Talk about detached from reality. Does he not know about the Iraq war, about Libya, about any of that stuff? It seems like the rest of the world is seeing this stuff as they describe it, but he's in some other place. While Americans of all stripes have seemingly turned against Israel recently because of what they've seen with their own eyes in Gaza and for the goading that President Trump got to go into this needless war with Iran, Kudlow and others like him don't see any of that stuff. They don't think Israel has done anything wrong at all. Wow. Here now the other side of the story also taking place in the United States. The New York Times is being sued by the Bibi Netanyahu government for its thorough reporting on Israeli abuses. They're not the first to report on this, but they are the first among media institutions in the West to usually only defend Israel to do so. The Times is supposed to carry water for Israel, don't you understand? And they usually do very well, by the way. But this piece by Nicholas Kristof, who is a good reporter. I know him. I used to debrief him once a week when I worked at NBC. He details in this story the horrifying allegations that Palestinians have brought to him. He interviewed these people, hundreds of them, men, women, children, describe how for years they've been beaten and tortured and sexually abused, sometimes with dogs and sometimes with things I don't even want to say on TV. In fact, the Times reporting of Netanyahu lately has begun to have a curious edge to it. Take, for example, this recent story detailing how Mr. Netanyahu walked into the White House and then talked Mr. Trump and his team into going to war with Iran. Here's what the story looks like. Here's what it says. So Bibi Netanyahu was allowed to go into the Oval Office, and then he and his Israeli staff, Netanyahu's Israeli staff, were ushered into a cabinet room. This is a place usually reserved only for U.S. officials. But wait, it gets even better. Because then the Israelis were led into the Situation Room. You know what the Situation Room is? That's where only U.S. top decision makers have secret meetings. Historically, they've met there to plan wars and other actions. Well, there, even President Trump is said, according to the New York Times reporting, to have taken a back seat in the Situation Room. He's the president. Rather than sit in his usual chair, Netanyahu instead led the meeting with his anti-Iran, pro-war presentation. Netanyahu was supported via satellite, by the way, in a meeting of U.S. officials by Israelis, the Mossad, the director of the Mossad, Israeli agents, as well as other Israeli officials. And the group that they were pitching is the most Zionist pro-Israel among Trump's administration. Susie Wiles was there, the White House chief of staff, former Netanyahu aide, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, defense secretary, John Ratcliffe, CIA director, all of these guys are right there with Israel. Missing was Vice President J.D. Vance, who probably was the only one who could have pushed back on this presentation and asked good questions. But conveniently, he was asked not to go to this meeting. Instead, President Trump invited who? Dios mío! His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his real estate and golf buddy, Steve Witkoff. Those guys, civilians, in a meeting in the Situation Room. Imagine what I just described. The Situation Room, a place reserved only for U.S. leaders, a place where no other foreign leader has ever entered, no less had a policy discussion, being used by Bibi Netanyahu and the Mossad to tell U.S. policymakers, some of whom have been on Israel's payroll for years, by the way, how to attack Iran. Incredible, but true. What do you think of that? Now let's talk about China. Fresh off its PR victory, and some would argue its tactical win as well against the United States. Next on the agenda now for China, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. He's going to arrive there any minute now. He'll be arriving in Beijing. We're gonna pick that up for you when it happens, by the way. We're told maybe, oh, I don't know. My producers told me in about 10 or 15 minutes. But, you know, could be less, could be more. Listen, there's nothing cute or cordial about this meeting or this relationship, right? Not about fanfare. This is a rock-solid relationship. Both of these men know what's at stake. The Western hegemony is as weak as perhaps it's ever been. And, in fact, it's the Iran war that has kind of pushed that to the edge or made that happen. So both Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi know that if the West could buy one of them off, could convince one of them to break up with the other one, right? If they could separate them somehow, oh, that would be huge, especially for Washington. So together, China and Russia are, and they know this, almost unbeatable. And if their alliance continues to attract or attracts other similar thinking nations, maybe in Iran, India, which are kind of already in the bag, or they're able to pick off countries like, let's say, countries in Africa, or countries in the Middle East, maybe a Brazil in Latin America, they would become an even more powerful alliance. And here's something else. What if they're able to pick off some of the fractured countries from Europe, let's say? See, this is really important, game-changing stuff. So let me share with you a video that I just found. This is going to blow you away. This is Xi talking to Putin the last time that they got together. Watch this. It's very revealing what he says to him about what they're accomplishing right now. Watch.
Это как раз сейчас перемены, которые не было в течение 100 лет. Там, где вместе двигаем эти перемены. Берегите, пожалуйста, дорогой друг.
Man, did you hear that? Changes? Let me read to you again. He said to him, these are changes we haven't seen for 100 years. And then he looks at Putin and says, and we're the ones... You know, we're the ones who are driving those changes together. They know what's at stake. For his part, Mr. Putin spoke before departing for Beijing about the importance of this bond that he's forged with the Xi and with all of China. Here's Putin.
Russian-Chinese trade continues to grow, having long since exceeded $200 billion. Mutual settlements are now conducted almost entirely in rubles and yuan, and major initiatives are being implemented in key areas of cooperation. The close Russian-Chinese strategic link plays an important stabilizing role on the world stage. At the same time, our friendship is not directed against anyone. Rather, we work for peace and common prosperity.
It's amazing how the world is changing right before our eyes. How do you miss this stuff? This is big stuff. Joining us now for a special weekly segment that we're debuting today is none other than Che Boz. Che is going to be talking to us about what's going on in Europe related to what we were talking about right here. As a matter of fact, you just got back from Dublin, didn't you?
Yeah, just back from the, beautiful European continent, let's say. Stability. I've come back.
Why does it look like your tongue is firmly stuck on the side of your cheek?
Because as I you feel say like that. I've actually come back to the civilization slightly.
Let's do this. This is a brand new segment. I'm very excited about this. Mm-hmm. We don't have like a catchy title for it yet, but we will. And in the meantime, you're going to be bringing us some of the things that you think are relevant and happening right now. So us started.
Yeah, I mean, just the view from Europe, what's actually happening there, you know, because I think it's so important that people at home understand that as things move, like you're talking about this multipolar world, Putin and Xi are right now together again.
Yeah.
And there's a very desperate sense in Europe that, you know, we have to kind of say yes, that this is maybe Mr. Putin getting told what to do by Xi. You know, he's gone to receive his orders. They're so desperate, right? And inside Europe, of course, the Europeans are talking to themselves constantly. The Americans are talking to the Chinese. Chinese are talking to the Americans, the Indians. Everyone else is talking out there in the big world, but the Europeans are very much talking to themselves, okay? And very interesting sort of little clip which we noticed was of Mr. Merz, the exceptionally unpopular German leader, Chancellor. Exceptionally unpopular. Let's have a listen to what he had to say about this sort of messaging that now Russia is some way a junior partner with China. Let's have a listen.
President Putin.
We do not expect fundamental changes in strategic relations between Russia and China at this time, but we certainly link this visit with the hope that President Xi will also influence President Putin to end this war in Ukraine, which he cannot win. On the contrary, every day, everyone faces greater human losses.
I think we can say, please, Mr. Merz, do not hold your breath because you will die very soon. I don't think there's any chance in hell that Mr. Xi is going to tell Mr. Putin what to do.
Yeah, but it all comes, interestingly, in Europe, in a Europe at the moment. It's like there's a circus going on within the circus. Mm. And what is this internal circus? It's all about, like, you know, look, in the background, you know, we had, Robert Fico going to come to Moscow here, attending the parade. And when he goes back, he actually said at a press conference, said, look, when I come back to Europe, after them complaining, not letting me fly to their airspace to come to Russia, everybody wants to talk to me. They even follow me into the toilets and say, what did Mr. Putin say to you, Robert? Okay? So that's what's actually going on.
I would never talk to that guy.
Yeah.
What did he say?
Exactly. Yeah, because so there's this, that's the outside, but on the inside, the circus within the circus is, who are we going to push forward now to say all the stuff that we promised for 4 years we would never say? Like, we've got to end this war. What's it going to take? What are we going to do about sanctions, energy, etc., etc.?
So these are people who don't understand the very things that we were just talking about, the things that I explained in my mono. Yeah. They don't understand any of that stuff.
Yeah, people like Kaja Kallas, you might suggest. Kaja Kallas, the ex-Estonian leader, Estonia, a tiny country.
Brilliant woman, though.
Yeah, you know, a mastermind, huge IQ. Now, Kaja has been suggesting herself as the person who would negotiate on behalf of Europe with the Russians. Of course, people like Maria Zakharova and Mr. Putin and Mr. Lavrov.
They would eat her lunch.
They just said, look, this is never going to happen. Now, but interesting, keeping the German sort of theme and the European theme, there has been mentions from the Russian side of a guy called Gerhard Schroeder, who Mr. Putin had a very good relationship with. There's also been mentions...
So wait. What you're saying is the Russians are trying to handpick or recommend who they would like to negotiate in Europe to kind of make amends.
Well, they're not
with
suggesting.
Europeans?
They're basically, the Russians have been very pragmatic about it. Like, they've been all along. And they're saying, look, we're not going to talk to certain people because it's pointless. I mean, Kaja Kallas is a woman who thought that Russia had invaded the 19th country.
Yeah,
she didn't know China and Russia had won the Second World War. I mean, this is an exceptionally detached human being.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue that's why she's in charge of diplomacy, because there is no diplomacy.
What about Ursula?
But Ursula as well, of course, is you know, these are avid Russophobes. There's no way the Russians are going to talk
to them. Same thing.
Yeah, Ruta, the same
Merz,
thing.
Same thing. Macron, same thing. Yeah. Starmer, same thing.
But even Angela Merkel, who had been touted, because remember, there's an angle here when it comes to Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. He spent 1985 to, I think, 1989 in Germany.
Yeah.
As an intelligence officer,
German.
Right?
Yeah,
he speaks fluent German.
Yes, yes.
I think two of his kids were born in Germany.
Yes.
So he understands Germany and the Germans understand him. He's given full-on speeches to the German parliament,
yes.
I think, back in 2001. So these guys understand each other to somewhat. And remember, Germany is still the preeminent power in Europe. Their, you know, their industry might be collapsing. They might have major problems in their social funds and their pension funds, but they're still the preeminent power. So they're the people that really need to be talked to, of course. And Mr. Putin knows that. Now, interestingly, they've also suggested the ex-leader of Germany, Miss Merkel, Frau Merkel, okay, mm-hmm. a very unpopular lady in parts of Europe now because she opened the borders in Europe. She came out today and said, I'm not going to go and talk to Mr. Putin. The people in charge have to go and talk to Mr. Putin. That's how it's got to be. Because when you're in charge of what you... She's basically saying you got to own what you've done.
Yeah.
And get out there and talk to them. Now, meanwhile...
Interesting.
Meanwhile...
So it's like they're afraid of him.
Well, I think they're not. I think they're afraid of having. Who's the person that's going to go out there and say, we backed the wrong horse? We got this so incredibly wrong.
Yeah.
Who are you going to ask to go out there to actually say, look, okay, look, sorry about that? I mean, everyone else hiding, looking around the corner, going, what's he going to say? But the Russians have always said, we're going to talk, but we're going to talk in a very pragmatic way. Our aims have to be achieved, et cetera, et cetera. So there's.
Don't want to be used.
Meanwhile, of course, very close to Germany, you've got the Baltic states, okay? These very vociferous, very small countries, okay?
Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably the loudest barking chihuahuas in the dog pack, very pro-NATO, very anti-Russian, etc., etc., despite the fact that the sanctions that they've aggressively pursued have probably damaged their economies far more than anybody else in the European Union.
By the way, for the record, I don't know if you know this, I know this, you know this, I'm sure, but they're tiny.
Tiny.
Like
I mean, Estonia's got 2 million people.
Yeah.
Lithuania. Now, we're going to talk about Lithuania. The Lithuanian...
The suburb I live in Miami, has more than Lithuania does.
Yeah,
Pembroke Pines has more people than Lithuania.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah.
And they've completely bought into the EU project. They would have been better off staying in a post-Soviet world, trading with Russia, in the Russian... They know, everybody knows. Most economists would suggest that too. Now, the Lithuanians have decided to come out with a very ingenious plan to attack Russia. Now, this is not sort of comedy. This is not the Moscow Mules. This is your show. But they want to attack Russia. And it was their foreign minister actually suggested this. He came out and said, look, we probably should just attack Russia. Now, the part of Russia they want to attack is a little place. Let's have a look at the map. You can check it out. Mm. It used to be Königsberg. It used to be the capital of Prussia, this place. You look at it on the map. It's isolated from Russia geographically. It's on the sea there, on the coast. It's a very...
Interesting.
It's a very, very strategically placed little
Kaliningrad.
Sliver.
Kaliningrad.
Kaliningrad.
Yeah.
It's named after... It used to be Königsberg. It got named after one of the founding Soviets, Kalinin. Now, this is a stone in the shoe for the European Union, surrounded by very unfriendly people. They've cut the rail links here. They're constantly threatening it. They're saying it's a sort of stationary aircraft carrier for the Russians. That's what some of them say about this, okay? Can you imagine that they would actually suggest engaging in a conflict with Russia over this internationally recognized piece of territory? There's no sort of...
And they're serious. So they basically want to bomb Kaliningrad, and Kaliningrad is part of Russia.
Kaliningrad is Russian territory.
Yeah,
it is actually Russian territory. It is Russia.
So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it would be crazy to do that.
Why? Well, it would cause an immediate counterstrike by Russia. And interestingly, the first countries that would, let's say, disappear in 20 minutes would be these very countries who suggest this. Now, meanwhile, while all this is going on, Russia is also carrying out some of the biggest nuclear triad exercises it's done in a long time. I mean, remember, the Russian Federation has the biggest nuclear arsenal on Earth, and it probably has the most advanced way of delivering these weapons, things like Oreshnik. Remember, none of us knew what was going on with Oreshnik until we saw Oreshnik being used. There's lots of things going on in the background as well. So the context of all this, to me, suggests, from the European perspective, having been there, and the sense among ordinary Europeans have had enough of the Ukrainian project. There was a poll done in Ireland which said less than 1% of Irish people now think Ukraine is a priority. It's not. The government is sending back these refugees. The tide has turned. You'd do well to find a Ukrainian flag flying in big European cities, except these Baltic states, that they're getting pushed and pushed and pushed by the avid Ukrainiacs, if you like, to keep this on the agenda. And you see the attacks on Russia with the drones. You see these type of open challenges to start a war with Russia. It smells of desperation.
Final question after all of that. Did you get a sense while you were back home or while you were talking to other people in European cities that the Europeans are starting to understand that they're not as important as they used to be, or are they still filled with themselves?
Look, when you talk to ordinary Europeans on the street, in the bars, in the restaurants, in the cafes, Now in some European cities, you could do well to find some Europeans. Immigration is such a big issue. Yeah. The big ticket issues for ordinary Europeans right now are immigration, cost of living, fuel. Yeah. I mean, there was farmers out on the street in Ireland when I was back there. The army deployed to pull them off the streets. People are desperate. And this desperation is noticed by the ruling political elite. Mm. The same people who are hiding and deciding, who are we going to push out to talk to Mr. Putin to say, look, this needs to end. Because what will really put pressure on the Europeans to end this will be their own domestic situation. And that's starting to bubble now.
Change is a coming to Europe.
I sense so, but we'll keep an eye on it.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks for the visit. Hell of a job, but you're good at this TV stuff, you know. Here's a question for you. Given how badly it went and how little leverage Mr. Trump had really going in, should he have canceled his trip to China before he met with Mr. Xi? You can't help but ask that based on what it resulted in the end, right? I'm going to ask that question of Carl Xia. He's one of the most noted analysts of relations between China and the West. He was born in China, moved to the United States, similar to my story in some ways, not China in my case, but Cuba. And he and I are going to chat when we come back. Do not go away. Well, let's have some more fun with all the crazy stuff that's going on in the world. And I can't wait for this next segment. This is Carl Xia, who's joining us. He hosts a podcast that's called Silk and Steel. Hundreds of thousands of people turn to him every single day to see what he has to say. And he's good enough to join us now. Mr. Carl, thank you, sir, for being with us. How you doing?
How are you, Rick?
I'm doing.
Nice to see you.
I'm doing great. My God, some of the things that are happening lately are just too rich. Maybe we start with Trump and Xi. You know, it almost seems like Trump was thinking he was going to show up in China and he was going to bring with him the heads of Venezuela and Iran and say, look, we now have all your oil, Mr. Xi, and we've got the best military in the world and we've got the best economy. Are you ready to give up yet? It almost seems like he went there thinking that and Xi almost looked at him like, are you crazy? Did I characterize that right?
Trump went to China thinking he has all the cards. It turns out all the cards are made in China because he has no control over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has a military control over the Strait of Hormuz, which U.S. can do nothing about to challenge Iran. And Trump wants China to give him rare earth for the U.S. military industrial complex, but he has nothing to trade for it. And in the end, he has to settle for some soybeans and Boeing airplanes. That's it.
Do you think part of the goal for either Mr. Trump or his handlers in the military industrial complex or, I don't know, Israel, whoever talked him into doing some of the silly things that he does, do you think they told him that he somehow would be able to decouple China and Russia, that he needs to go there and separate those two and he can pull it off? It's easy. It can be done kind of thing.
I think that's what they definitely told him, at least during his first Trump's first term. And that's what he has tried to do, you know, this. But it hasn't worked because China and Russia, they have complementary economies, they have complementary interests. For Russia, its strategic priority is still Europe, Ukraine. And for China, the top priority is Taiwan. And China and Russia share a very long international border, which both like to see it stabilize and remain peaceful. So they both have a very strong interest to maintain a strong friendly ties. On top of that, Russia is the world's top producer of commodities, oil and gas, and China is the world's largest consumer of oil and gas and natural resources. So these two countries work naturally together.
Let's talk about Taiwan. Help me understand how, in the aftermath of the Trump-Xi meetings, the situation in Taiwan has either changed, not changed, negatively, or positively. What's your assessment?
Well, I think right now we're going to see a period of stability in the Sino-American relationship. What I mean is, as a result of the decimal performance of U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf, mm-hmm. now even the decision maker in Washington have realized, if United States cannot take on Iran, forget about China. You know, like, this is just out of the question. That's a fantasy for United States to cross the entire Pacific Ocean to fight China. And this is exactly what Trump said. He said, Taiwan is very close to China, but it's very far from us. And he is finally admitting to the reality. But what Xi Jinping actually said is, look, if you know this about the Thucydides trap,
yeah,
you know, you don't have to fall into it. You don't have to fall into the trap. Just
let's not go to war. Right. Let's not go to war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very simple. And this is a persistent a theme that Xi Jinping brought up over and over again to United States. Like, he said, the world is big enough for both U.S. and China. We can coexist together. But this is not something that Washington elite believes in, because they only believe in zero-sum game.
Yeah.
For them to win, they think everybody else have to lose.
Correct. You know,
the only type of competition they believe in is the Tony Harden type of competition, where they literally kneecap their competitors.
Why is that? Have you thought about, I mean, you were born in China, but you're as American as I am. What is it about my country that has made it become this way? Some people say it's a cowboy mentality. Some people say it's a bullying mentality. I tend to think it's neither. I think it's just money. That's all. The reason this happens is driven by the money and by the power. No?
I think the money is definitely part of it. I mean, the military-industrial complex in the United States need to be fed constantly.
Yes.
This is why we pivot from war to war to war. I mean, Assange said this famously about Afghanistan war. He said, it's not even about winning Afghanistan. It's about to wash vast sum of money from tax bases of North America and Europe into pockets of a small transnational security elite. And this is why they have to constantly start tensions and start wars. This is why they don't believe in the win-win narrative that was proposed by the Chinese. They have to have tensions so they can continue to sell weapons to Taiwan, for example. You know, Taiwan is one of the best customers for the U.S. military industrial complex.
Wouldn't that be like China giving arms to Florida?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, am I exaggerating?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, isn't love it, hate it, wish it would separate from China or not? Taiwan is still officially a state or a province or whatever the hell you want to call it, a territory that belongs to China, correct?
Western media acting like Taiwan is a country, but most of these journalists didn't even read the official statement from their own government, because United States government do not maintain an embassy on Taiwan. It does not recognize Taiwan as a country. And that is the official position for most of the Western government as well. So it's incredible that the media is trying to pretend Taiwan is this country, independent country.
Make me understand how it is that Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi have become what seemingly are such close friends. Especially given the background of the fact that China and Russia historically couldn't stand each other.
Well, one important thing to note is the Sino-Soviet split was over in 1989, officially, when Gorbachev visited Beijing to meet with Mr. Deng Xiaoping.
Okay.
And since then, China and Russia has enjoyed a friendly relationship. But in more recent years, because particularly of the pressure from the United States, I really have pushed China and Russia together. Now, both President Putin and President Xi Jinping, they have lived through the end of the Cold War 1.0. You know, they both witnessed the collapse of Soviet Union. Mm. And they saw the devastation that was caused in among the population of the former Soviet Union. So they definitely do not want that. They do not want a repeat of that. But you, that's very much on U.S. agenda. You know, U.S. is supporting all these revolutions in order to cope. So Russia and China has a very strong incentive to work together to oppose the U.S. hegemony.
Couldn't you argue, though? I would make this argument. I don't know if you think I'm full of crap or not on this, but the most recent escalatory, castigatory actions by the West, sanctions, tariffs, freezing assets, providing neighbors with weapons so they can attack Russia, for example, and the key, all of these things that they've done to China and Russia, in Russia's case, Ukraine, in China's case, Taiwan, have only made China and Russia become closer and closer and closer to the point now where they're all but making out. Am I right?
That's exactly it. You know, the Washington, you're absolutely right, Rick, because, you know, all these Washington foreign policy wonks are scratching their heads like, what? China and Russia, they're not supposed to like each other. Yeah. You know, we remember the Sino-Soviet split. What happened? But you are the ones that making it happen. You are the one pushing these two together to kiss. And then you have the people like John McCain and all these neocons calling Russia like a gas station with nukes. I mean, I have been to Moscow.
Yeah.
If that's a gas station with nukes, that's the most beautiful gas station I have ever seen.
Yeah, and I recently went to Beijing, and I was really completely taken aback by the order, by the friendliness, by, you know, I saw all these police officers walking around, and I thought, oh, God, these guys are going to come after me. I'm American. I've got a microphone. They're going to put me in jail. They're going to ask me questions. They came up, and they said, well, you know, what are you doing here? I said, actually, I was doing a stand-up, but now what I'd like is to go find a certain type of food. They go, what kind of food do you want? I said, well, I was kind of looking for something maybe Korean or something like that. They go, come on, we'll take you. And these guys, the cops, they literally walked me over there and gave me choices of two different restaurants. And I thought, oh, my God, I thought they were taking me someplace else. But what I found was, and I found this in Iran, to be fair, I found this in China, and I found this in Russia, nothing like what we in the West believe it is. And we are intentionally lied to about these countries, aren't we?
You know, a lot of the talking points in the United States about Russia, China, or Iran, or whatever the perceived adversary is, it's almost 100% projection, you know, because we both live in the United States. So we know the relationship that we do have as U.S. citizens have with the cops. You know, you're supposed to fear the cops. and this is why we get nervous when we saw the presence of cops. But in countries like China, the relationship is completely different. You know, people go up to the cops to ask for direction. No, you just don't imagine that in the United States.
That's actually a really good point. I got to tell you, you know, they say, well, you have to be Black or Hispanic to be afraid when a cop pulls you over in the United States. Bull crap. When any police officer pulls any citizen over in the United States, most people are pretty close to urinating on themselves because they're so afraid of what's going to happen. Now, some of that is also media hype because we constantly see the stories on social media and stuff like that. So it's exaggerated. But still, you can't take away the fact that people in the United States are afraid of authority more than people in China, I found, were afraid of authority. When I went to China, I asked my driver, what do you think of Xi? And he said, I don't like him. He's a princeling. I don't like him. So there you go. By the way, I'm being told now the first pictures are coming in of Mr. Putin. There it is. There's Mr. Putin's plane arriving in Beijing for this historic meeting between he and the president of China, a meeting that many have looked forward to. What do you make, Xia, of the timing of this? The fact that, you know, it's like... Like Trump is going out the back door and Mr. Putin's coming in the front door. I mean, the timing of these two meetings is pretty remarkable, isn't it? What do you make of that? Was it planned?
It's definitely planned because all these trips have been, you know, planned way in advance with all the equipment that needs to be shipped in, all the deal that has.
Yeah. he freezes
needs
up.
To be made. And if you notice, visit to China was preceded by the Iranian foreign minister's visit to China. So the Iranian foreign minister and Mr. Putin, the sandwich Trump's visit to Beijing. There's obviously a degree of coordination between Iran, China, and Russia. You know, at this time when U.S. is launching unprecedented aggression against the global South.
You know what I'm thinking about? I mean, the Chinese went a little overboard trying to make Trump feel like the most important man in the world. I mean, with the cheerleaders and the songs and, I mean, it was kind of like they were stroking him, right, as we say in the United States. I don't think they're going to need to do that with Putin. I think this is going to be more of a business and personal moment between these two leaders. But I'm just saying that. I have no idea. I haven't looked at the plans. I don't know any of the people who are planning this, so I don't know. That's my guess. What's yours?
I tend to agree with you because the relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi is a relationship between adults. You know, Trump is like a dangerous toddler. You need to cuddle him. And China, no, they have to stroke him a little bit because they know, like, Trump is all about ego. You just satisfy his ego, then, you know, you make him happy so he doesn't throw a tantrum while he was in Beijing. You don't need to do that with Mr. Putin.
Well, and it's also, by the way, to our viewers, you're looking at live pictures. These are live pictures coming in to us right now. This is the plane carrying the president of Russia and the Russian delegation, who is going to be having meetings effective today with the delegation of China, post the meetings that were held between the United States and China. And most people are expecting these indeed to be different. And part of it, you know what it is, too? I think it's about a more mature relationship. I'll give you an example. You and I have been friends for 10 years now. You come to my house, I come to my house. You're able to come to my refrigerator, open it, and take a beer without even generally having to ask me because we've been hanging out together for so long. We'll play tennis, we'll play golf, you'll come over, we'll just sit around. I don't need to have fanfare for you. I don't need to greet you at the door. Usually you'll just come in. Yeah, come on in, right? That's kind of what this relationship with Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi is like. Obviously, I'm exaggerating. It's not that casual. But compared to one where no one's ever been to your home before, so you're going to go crazy to try and make them feel super comfortable. And that's kind of what I saw with Trump, that it wasn't familiar, right?
I think you are definitely onto something here. And whereas Putin and Xi, they actually make pancakes together, if you remember.
Yes.
Literally.
I remember the video of that, as a matter of fact. I think it is more collegial. I think these guys, you know, and that says something for the problem with the United States. And I'm not going to use the democracy word or anything else. The fact that they change their governments like most people change their underwear, I think sometimes is a drawback for them because it puts a President Trump or a President Biden or anybody in a situation where they're all new to this stuff. Whereas a guy like Lavrov goes to China, he could write the book on China. This guy's been there so many times, right? That's good, probably.
And you have a situation where Trump can come in and just tore up agreement the previous administration signed, like the JCPOA with Iran. And you know, like, how can you trust, like, how can you trust to do a deal with a government like that when you know that deal could be completely invalid in 4 years? And also, you know, there's another thing with United States. I remember
just interrupting you for a minute. Just let our viewers know we're seeing the Presidential Honor Guard now making its way toward the plane. We'll soon see the doors open. As the doors open, the Presidential Honor Guard will line up. We'll likely see something like a red carpet that's going to be laid out for the president, and he's going to be met with the people who are going to be meeting. And we don't know. And this would be substantial, by the way. Let me just say this. If Mr. Xi comes to the airport and personally greets Mr. Putin, although he didn't do that for Mr. Trump, that would be an important signal they're sending to the world, I think.
Right, right.
I don't know what's going to happen. We're all sitting here watching together. But it'd be a help. What do you think? You follow.
No, I agree. If that were to happen, you know, I don't know exactly what the protocol is, you know, the diplomatic protocol in such a situation is.
Yeah.
But if that were to happen, it definitely, it's a shift. It definitely emphasized the difference in the level of the relationship that was between the two countries. But now we see all these people are getting ready to greet Putin to come on the plane.
Yeah, and it looks like they're some form of entertainers along with the presidential guard.
Yeah.
And for Mr. Trump, they did like this cheerleading chant that was cool and fun to watch. They're probably going to wave flags or do something with Mr. Putin. That would be a regular action that they've done in the past. We don't know at this point, but it's going to be illustrative to find out and to watch this and to see how this actually unfolds. Now we're seeing the media be let in, and I've been a part of that in the past. I know what it's like. They open the gates, they let you go, and you guys are, it's like a scrum and you're fighting for the position. The thing you want most is to be able to shout out a question that Mr. Putin will hear. You know, who knows if that's going to be happened. But I interrupted you a little while ago. I don't know if you remember what you were saying, and I apologize for doing that.
I actually lost my train of thought. I do not remember. But we can just vibe, you know, we can just vibe. Because this is a very important meeting, obviously. And we are all quite eager to find out what's about to happen when that door opens and Mr. Putin walks out.
They're rolling out.
There's a rolling of the red carpet.
There it is. Yeah. They're literally rolling out the red carpet for Mr. Putin. Of course, we shouldn't make much more of that than it really is. They would do that for any leader who was going to China at this time. And by the way, the Chinese are very astute. They're very effective, and they're very sensitive to this type of situation. They're not in any way normally braggadocious. They're somewhat mild-mannered, but they also are very studious. It has seemed to me, following them and covering these kinds of things in the past for years, they're very studious and very respectful of these kinds of moments. And they're not usually going to make mistakes or faux pas, as we say, in these kind of situations.
Yeah, these are the greeting team probably to practice, you know, to rehearse, to make sure everything will go off without a hitch.
We haven't seen Mr. Putin yet, but he should be coming out of the plane in just a little bit. We're not sure yet who else is in this delegation. My producer, Boris, if you have that list or if they've released the list of who's traveling with Mr. Putin, I'd love to see that. You can send it to me. I've got my accounts open here on my computer. If you want to send that, that'd be a cool thing to know. That also often says something about what kind of what kind with the Russians and with the Chinese, more so than with the Americans, knowing who's there will tell you what they're going to talk about in many ways. Because I have noticed we Americans or in the West will send somebody who you would think, why in the world is that guy there? I mean, suddenly Donald Trump's son-in-law shows up at a meeting. Whereas with the Chinese and with the Russians, they're people who have been trained for decades to deal with that subject matter. And if they're there, that means they're going to talk about that subject matter, right?
That's correct. Everyone is there for a reason. There's no, there's no like Trump's son and Trump's daughter-in-law tagging along just for the trip.
Mm. I wonder if that's the beast. That's the so-called limousine that the president of Russia often uses, which they say is a really cool car because it's got all the cool gadgets in it, which I'm sure all presidents have by now. But that he's going to be boarding one of those very soon and making...
They flew them in.
They did, right?
They flew them in before. Yeah. They flew them in from Russia before the trip.
And that's kind of just the protocol, right? Because I don't think it's a big security issue with China. I mean, if Mr. Trump attends in Miami the G20, for example, that he's been invited to, I guarantee you they'd bring in 20 big beasts or whatever they're called. But looking at China, but then again, it's you want to be respectful. So if we're going to do it in another country, we got to do it here. That way people don't say, oh, yeah, you didn't bring it to China because you trust them, but you don't trust us. So just do everything the same way, I imagine, is the decision that's being made by the Kremlin. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because Trump, during the Trump visit, they also flew in Trump's motorcade from United States on the U.S. Air Force.
And that's a security thing, right?
Yeah.
More than anything else.
Yeah.
Boris, did you send it to me yourself? I'm going to it now. Hold on. You sent me something on, did Trump peak? No. I'm being told by, and I, for some reason I didn't get if you sent me. I don't know if my, oh yes, I'm sorry. You know what I did? You're gonna love this. My Wi-Fi wasn't turned on. So I'll make sure it is when I come down here from now on. And there is the president of Russia being greeted now by the Chinese officials. By the way,
Boris, Chinese. That's the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, who is shaking Mr. Putin's hand.
And he is by far one of the most prominent officials in all of China, other than Xi himself, isn't he? No question.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is a foreign minister, so he's going to be around all the major diplomatic meetings. Yeah.
By the way, I was told that Mr. Putin's delegation has mostly economic people. Siluanov is going to be there, who I interviewed here not long ago. And others, including members of the business community of Russia, are also going to be there. Mr. Putin seems delighted to be there. He doesn't look too worn out or too tired after that 8 or 9 hour trip from Russia. He's got a little skip in his step, as we like to say. There he is walking now with the foreign minister. Notably, Mr. Xi did not greet Mr. Putin there at the airport. I don't know if you what you make of that. If anything.
I think maybe that's just a standard protocol, because I think Xi Jinping is just going to wait to receive the head of the state in Tiananmen Square, where they have the official welcoming ceremony.
Now, you'll notice it's the same kind of greeting they did. Can we hear this? Can we hear this, guys? Turn up the sound for us. Do you know what they're saying?
I can make an educated guess. I think they're saying 欢迎, 欢迎, 这里欢迎, which is welcome, welcome,
welcome.
You know, we cordially welcome you. Yeah.
Now, you notice when they did this for Trump, he stopped and he started like raising his arms and marveling in some ways, almost like, you know, like Julius Caesar kind of thing, like, oh my God, they're here to greet me. And Mr. Putin kind of downplayed it. I mean, he was polite and he looked at him and gestured, but he didn't stop and make it a moment. He just said, well, this is part of the welcoming ceremony, and I'm just going to continue walking with the Minister of Interior with him and continue my jaunt. So that's interesting, the two different ways these two leaders did that.
That's because Mr. Putin is an actual world leader. You know, he doesn't need to stop to do photo ops to puff himself up. Because, you know, if you're a real strong man, you don't need to tell the world you are the strongest man. If you're Mike Tyson, you just show up. Your presence will fill the room.
Yeah, and it almost seems like he was just engaged in conversation with the foreign minister as they were walking down the red carpet, and he did it somewhat briskly. Like, we're here to conduct business. We're not here to pound our chest. We're not here to show off. We've got meetings to have, and thank you very much, but I got to get on my way. He was almost very matter of fact about this whole thing, no?
Yeah, yeah, and very casual. You know, he's very, with very brisk steps.
I'm being told that Mr. Putin is not expected to make any comments. Sometimes they'll arrive and, you know, have a situation where they'll make comments, but he's... Okay, okay. But it doesn't look like Mr. Putin is going to be making any comments at the airport, which probably makes sense. I think this really is more about getting down to business, and that's exactly what they're going to be doing. And there we see his motorcade now driving away. with the president of Russia, to engage in meetings with the president of China. This is, look, no matter how you look at it, yeah, they may be familiar to each other. They may have already had a very suitable relationship, but this is still historic.
Yeah, yeah. They're probably going to head to the hotel to rest a bit for tomorrow's big event, which is official welcoming ceremony in the Tiananmen Square with President Xi Jinping, and the official meeting that will commence.
What is it with China and this kind of thing? They're so good at this. They love doing this. What are they called? Where people practice to make the right stuff, like a marching band kind of thing. And they bring this kind of thing everywhere. Is it like a big deal to be a part of this?
I mean, China is all about protocol. They love protocols. They love to make a spectacle, especially welcoming foreign leaders. It's a show of respect, right?
Yeah.
It's showing the respect. Yeah.
And look how serious they are. I mean, this is like, you know, I noticed that when I was there before, when they put on the shows, that they're very rigid, they're very practiced, they're very rehearsed, and it's different. You don't see this in most other countries, but you certainly see it in China, and I think it's meaningful, right?
The whole idea is they're gonna be there to present the image of. For China, that they're welcoming the important foreign dignitaries, but also present a disciplined image of China.
Wow. Well, Carl, that was so nice of you to be with us while we were going through that. That's really cool. We were live. It's a historic moment. We watched the president of Russia arriving to join his colleague, really, the president of China, colleague in the business that they attend to. So let me ask you one final question before we let you go. And I think this is like the money question.
Sure.
When this is done in a couple of days, what do you think will be the headline? What will be the takeaway or the one you would write? If you were asked by your editor to write the story after these two men have met?
Well, this very, very easy. Continued strengthening of Sino-Russian relationship, consolidation of the BRICS in the face of American aggression, and a new future for a global alliance for global peace and stability.
Wow. Carl Xia, our guest on this day, as he's taking us through this historic moment, as we have been able to hopefully take you and give you some insight as to what's going to be happening with these two presidents as they meet, forging what is now one of the most important and powerful alliances in the world, if not, some would argue, already the most powerful alliance in the world. Carl, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your help. We'll look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you, Rick. My pleasure.
As usual, we'd like to tell you thank you. We appreciate the fact that you're there with us. We try to bring you the very latest as it happens, whether it's live or on Memorex, as they say. And we want to thank you for being on social media. As you know, we are heavy into X lately with millions of you joining us there. We're on Spotify. We're on BitChute. Expect changes and... believe it or not, we're back on YouTube. I don't know how it happened, but suddenly hundreds of thousands of you are watching us on BitChute again. I can't guarantee that we'll be there long. They may kick me out because they think I'm a communist or something. I don't know. Or that I'm in Russia or that I'm in China or wherever the hell I'm, whatever I'm doing or whatever it is, the explanation they come up with next. But in the meantime, let's enjoy it. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for letting us into your homes, and we'll be looking for you next time.